From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News. Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times, Ashraf Khalil, Washington, D.C. Metro Reporter for the Associated Press, and our moderator is Dan Revive, columnist for Newsday.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues from yet another historic week here in America's capital city, the first full week of a new year. Thousands of protesters who came here from around the country pledging loyalty to Donald Trump, saying they would fight to let him continue as president of the United States, invaded the United States Congress, breaking into the Capitol building with its landmark white dome overhead. In scuffles with police, one of the trespassers, a woman from California, was shot dead. Three other people died in medical emergencies. President Trump, in a video message, said he loves the protesters, but told them to go home. And the next morning, on Thursday, the White House put out a statement that there will be, quote, an orderly transition to a new president, meaning Joe Biden, on January 20th. We'll also analyze the election results in Georgia, a big win for Biden's party, the Democrats, winning control of the United States Senate. And the continuing tragedy of the coronavirus, actually worse than ever. Josh Glancy, you're a British reporter covering America. The last time the Capitol building was invaded was by British troops in the War of 1812. More than 200 years later, we all saw an insurrection, this time by American citizens trying to stop Congress from confirming Joe Biden's victory. Josh, what did you see?
Well, it was in many ways unprecedented and unbelievable scenes that we saw in the Capitol on Wednesday. I think on one level, it has to be viewed as an enormous failure of security. We all knew that this protest was going to happen. Anyone who follows the movement around Trump or the president himself saw the warning signs. They were very public about them. And yet when this group of very agitated protesters arrived at the Capitol building, the defenses were hugely insufficient. There were the Capitol Hill cops, and they were not there in great numbers, and they didn't seem to have any backup. And so on one level, we can see this as an enormous failure of policing and of national security. I mean, the fact is they had to, you know, evacuate the vice president at one point. He's number two in line to the presidency. You know, I mean, it's inexcusable on that level. On another level, obviously, there's a huge amount of recrimination has to go to the president for supporting and inciting this group of people to go and not just protest outside Congress, but invade the inner sanctums. I mean, you saw a guy with his feet up on Nancy Pelosi's office. You saw people waving the broken up plaque of the sign outside that says it's her office. They'd smashed it up and they were waving it in the halls of Congress. You saw a woman shot and killed. And we don't know the exact details of how this happened. An Air Force veteran who was protesting and was shot in the halls of Congress. These are astonishing scenes. I mean, as someone pointed out recently, America spends nigh on $1 trillion a year on defense and yet wasn't able to protect the halls of Congress. You know, that's an astonishing moment in the history of this republic.
It does seem that there will be hearings on just that very issue, the security of Congress. And you're right, more than $500 million in the annual budget of the United States Capitol Police. But what about the passions? I mean, what do we say about tens of thousands of people who really believe that there was cheating in the November election, that Donald Trump is being forced out of office wrongly? Ashraf Khalil, right, you cover this city for the Associated Press. You've reported on tumultuous events, including anti-Trump protests, changing of a city street near the White House. It's now called Black Lives Matter Plaza. This time it was like the pro-Trump side. Tens of thousands of his strongest supporters came to this city. They got a speech by the president. They marched to the Capitol. In everything you've seen, did you suppose that there would be a violent invasion of the Capitol building?
Well, having seen the last two prior pro-Trump protests, there was one in November, there was one in December, you could see an escalation in numbers and in violent tactics. The first one in November, I think, drew around 15,000 people. The one in December drew fewer. attendees, but a much larger contingent of people wearing Proud Boy colors, this sort of almost militia group that's taking the forefront in this movement. And they were very violent and they were looking for a fight. So I was expecting an escalation on those terms. The surprise was, as Josh said, the total failure to protect the building. This is the U.S. Capitol. And basically, they faced almost zero resistance to get to the Capitol grounds. There was a fence around the Capitol grounds, but it was the kind of fencing that you put up temporarily to keep like deer and stuff out of your garden. It was not a fence. It was not the kind of fence that's around Lafayette Park and around the White House. And I think they were just caught flat-footed by the focus of the protesters. This is something me and my colleagues were sort of hashing out in the aftermath, in that this wasn't a protest that sort of like went weird. You know, a lot of us have covered protests where somebody breaks a window and then everything goes mob violence and then sort of the madness of crowds. This was not necessarily organized, but it was very focused. They knew exactly what they wanted to do, and they kind of like probed the different ways to get into the building and to the steps and to pass the police. And it was hugely successful from their perspective.
Let's keep in mind that it started while the United States Congress was performing a vital ceremonial duty. Every 4 years after a presidential election, Congress, you could say, counts the votes. Now, they don't really do the count. The envelopes or certificates are opened from all 50 states and Washington, D.C. The vice president acts as the president of the Senate. And as the senators and House members are sitting together, state by state, the results are read aloud, and normally they're just accepted without any problem. This time it was clear that supporters of President Trump in both the House and the Senate would object, and that process had begun. It's alphabetical. So Alaska was no problem, Alabama no problem. But when they got to Arizona, well, then the House and Senate went into separate sessions to debate, and that's when the violence started. And that's when members of the House of Representatives had to actually get down on the floor and police, plainclothes police, right, holding their guns, pointing at the doors of the House of Representatives chamber to keep the rioters out of the chamber, whereas the protesters or rioters did get into the Senate chamber just after the vice president and 100 senators, all 100, were evacuated. It was a chaotic scene, but I didn't want to lose sight of the business. The business did get done. The Senate and House resumed their work late Wednesday night. They worked until about 4 o'clock in the morning on Thursday. And it is official now that Joe Biden, former vice president, former senator, will be the president, sworn in on January 20th. Kamala Harris, who's been a senator from California, will be the vice president. Josh, you know, in a way, at least America did fulfill its function, or Congress, you know, Congress did step up and do it.
They did. And it's really important that after the awful scenes we saw on Wednesday afternoon and evening, that Congress came back and did their duty and certified the results. And that's what's always been strange about this process that we've had of Trump denying and seeking to overturn the election results, is that it's never ever felt likely that it would happen. There's never been a massive support both in Congress or even beyond it for Trump's attempts. I mean, anyone who really looks carefully at what happened knows that there wasn't mass electoral fraud. But nonetheless, this performance has continued with these protests, with Trump's tweets, with these frivolous lawsuits being launched and then chucked out of court. And it carried on, this process, and it was almost felt as though there wouldn't be any serious repercussions, as though they could have run this election denialism. And there were people in Congress who said, well, they're not going to overturn the election, so why don't I give it a nod and a wink? You know, we're just raising questions, that sort of thing. Well, what we saw this week is that actions have consequences, and those consequences came to the very heart of American power, to the very heart of Washington, D.C., and we'll be living with them for a very long time.
Yeah, we'll have to see what the consequences are, or whether everyone in U.S. politics just wants to turn the page on January 20th. So for the record, the Senate and the House did debate some objections about some of the states, but a typical vote was on the Arizona objection. The United States Senate voted 92-7 to reject the objection. In other words, to accept the Electoral College numbers. And so it was overwhelming. But if one thinks about it, in the House of Representatives, with more than 100 of the 435 members wanting to reject the official count, That meant that more than half of the Republicans in the House were taking Trump's side. Now, this put Vice President Mike Pence in a situation of great pressure. President Trump publicly said that his Vice President Mike Pence, as ceremonial president of the Senate, should reject the numbers, send it back to the states, make them come up with new results so Trump could continue as president. Ashraf, the pressure was amazing, but Pence decided to just follow the script and act dignified.
Yeah, Pence was subject to intense speculation for the last week, really, and a lot on Wednesday. I spoke to one protester just before, just as they were getting started with the roll call of the states that only got to Arizona, as you said. And he was a minister, the head of a Christian NGO in Philadelphia. And he was putting a lot of stock in Pence. I was like, what do you think Pence is going to do? He's like, I don't know. He must be under a lot of pressure. And I said, it's okay. As a fellow man of faith, if Pence looks at the law and looks at his conscience and comes to the honest conclusion that I cannot interfere in this way, will that satisfy you? And he thought about it for a while. He's like, I think I could probably be at peace with that. And that's kind of the question, is who among the supporters now, who is Pence going to become a villain? The way that Bill Barr, the former attorney general, immediately became a villain with this crowd? Or is the fact that he, as the man who kind of lent sort of moral armor in a way to many of President Trump's excesses in the minds of the Christian right, is he choosing not to fight this fight going to sway some of them with his credibility? Because we've seen when Bill Barr came out and said he couldn't find electoral fraud, the attorney general, immediately I was talking to protesters that were like, oh, he's a sellout. Oh, I had a woman tell me, oh, everyone knows he's good friends with Joe Biden. So is everyone going to turn on Pence now, or is his personal credibility going to sort of add a little bit of legitimacy or to take away some of the sting for these people?
As we're hearing, there are still strong divisions when it comes to politics in America. There were election results from Georgia that really will make a difference in Congress. We'll talk about that and a lot more after this short break.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times. Ashraf Khalil, Washington, D.C. Metro reporter for the Associated Press. And our moderator, Dan Raviv, columnist for Newsday.
Just before our break, Ashraf was saying that Vice President Mike Pence had been under pressure. And what the pro-Trump protesters, some of whom, thousands of whom apparently broke into the Capitol building, what they thought about Pence as though the vice president would save their hero, President Trump, what they expected. In the end, it was Pence at 3:45 in the morning on Thursday who officially announced that Trump and Pence had lost and that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris had won the election. And Biden and Harris will be sworn in right there, just outside the Capitol building on January 20th. Josh Glancy, what's your take on the drama around Mike Pence?
Well, I think Mike Pence has shown himself to be someone who believes in the system and isn't willing to bend entirely under the will of his boss, Donald Trump. There have been times over the last few years when he's been somewhat quiet and reserved and withdrawn as a figure and has signaled his frustrations with the president very subtly. But when called upon this week to support the American system and the transfer of power and the Constitution and his duty as vice president, he did so. Behind the scenes, we know from reporting that Vice President Pence was absolutely furious with Donald Trump's failure to respond to the violence we saw in the Capitol. And it's been reported that it was ultimately the vice president and not Donald Trump who called in the National Guard and called in reinforcements to end the scenes in Congress. So you don't necessarily have to like Mike Pence or admire Mike Pence, but he has done his constitutional duty as vice president this week. And that's very important, because had he not, then we'd be in an even messier situation.
As for President Trump, he was banned at least for 12 hours from Twitter. That company, Twitter, decided no longer to put out the messages from President Donald Trump. No videos from Trump. Facebook made the same decision, meaning that Trump was also banned from YouTube. Those corporations decided that some of what Trump has been saying has been dangerous, has been mistaken, has been false, has been inciting trouble in the United States. Of course, this will cause more trouble in the sense of political conservatives thinking that Twitter, Facebook, and other social networking companies should not have this power to censor and decide who gets to be there. Anyway, there was a Twitter statement from a White House official on Thursday morning. It says Donald J. Trump declares, quote, "Even though I totally disagree with the outcome of the election and the facts bear me out, nevertheless, there will be an orderly transition on January 20th. President Trump in this statement says it's just the beginning of, quote, our fight to make America great again. But he is confirming, apparently, he'll be leaving on January 20th. And there is a big change. It's not only a Democrat. Joe Biden will be the president. Democrats still control the House of Representatives, though they did lose seats in November. But the United States Senate was just on the razor's edge. Would the Republicans hold it? Well, they won't. We got the results from Georgia, special runoff elections. Two Republicans who held their Senate seats, Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue, they lost. They're gone. And the winners are the Reverend Raphael Warnock and documentary filmmaker John Ossoff. In America's Deep South, a state, Georgia, thought of as highly conservative, by a small margin, gave both victories to liberal candidates, a black church preacher, Warnock, and a Jewish journalist, notably only 33 years old, John Ossoff. So Josh Glancy, again, Georgia has surprised America. Do you think that was a response in part to Trump and his big outdoor rally on the eve of the Georgia election?
Well, I think it would be too simplistic to draw a direct line and say that, you know, Trump lost Republicans Georgia. There's a lot of factors at play there. The Republicans ran two not hugely impressive candidates, both who had somewhat scandalous associations with allegations of insider trading around the pandemic, Loeffler and Perdue. The Democrats have run a really impressive get out the vote operation in Georgia for many years now, or several years, I should say, spearheaded by Stacey Abrams, a local activist and politician. So there are a lot of factors at play in Georgia. But nonetheless, you would have to look at the way Trump has gone to war with the Georgia Republican Party, including Governor Brian Kemp, the way allies of his have undermined the process and the election in Georgia, the call that was leaked that Trump had with a Georgia election official asking him to overturn the election. None of that is likely to have helped, because the reason Republicans lost in Georgia in November was because they alienated a lot of moderate suburban voters who previously were probably quite solidly Republican, but don't like the direction the party's taken under Trump and delivered the state to Joe Biden in November and appear to have delivered now the state to the Democrats again. And now they've given them control of the Senate, which changes the landscape of American politics for the next 2 years. So there's a lot of frustration in Republican ranks at the way that Trump and his allies muddied the waters and upset the apple cart, shall we say, down in Georgia with their allegations against the election. And it certainly hasn't helped them and has had electoral consequences.
Well, there are many signs that the Republican Party has internal divisions, not only in Georgia, but nationwide. And if the United States Senate now will be 50 Democrats and 50 Republicans, Ashraf Khalil, it falls to you to explain to our global VOA News audience, 50-50, how is that a majority for the Democrats?
Well, when it's a 50-50 tie, the deciding vote is cast by the sitting vice president. So 50-50 becomes a majority. And so that makes Kamala Harris the deciding, essentially, tiebreaker going forward in these things. So the way that the American government is structured, that affects the checks and balances between the executive branch and the legislative branch. It certainly affects, especially on contentious issues that are likely to go down on a hard partisan split. So that comes up with a bunch of different issues, not only healthcare reform, either bringing back some form of Obamacare or the subject of whether Washington, D.C. should become a state. I can almost guarantee that's going to come up during the next 2-year window. So if Republicans had retained control of the Senate has a lot of powers that are unique just to the Senate. And a Republican-led Senate could have greatly delayed or even derailed many, many, many of the major initiatives that a new Biden administration would have wanted to put in. So this really does clear the runway for sweeping changes.
And very soon, the United States Senate will be called upon to confirm or reject dozens of important nominations by Joe Biden as he becomes president. Who will be his attorney general? Who will fill other cabinet positions? We heard that Merrick Garland, who had been Barack Obama's nominee for the Supreme Court, but the Republican-led Senate refused to even consider Garland back in 2016, that now he will be Biden's nominee to be attorney general. And because of what happened in the Georgia election, well, that means that Biden will probably get his entire cabinet confirmed. We have to talk about COVID-19, worse than ever. You know, last year, on average, about 1,000 Americans died every day since the pandemic began in March of last year. Lately, it's been well over 3,000 deaths a day. Hospitals in major cities, notably Los Angeles, are absolutely paralyzed with every bed being used to treat people. And in LA, ambulance drivers were ordered to assess, does this person have a chance to survive, let's say after a heart attack? And if they seem to have little chance, don't bring them to the hospital. Josh, this is just a shock for the American healthcare system, which has proven itself to be fragmented. Even the vaccines aren't being delivered in a quick and efficient way into the arms of America.
Yes, unfortunately, we're seeing the continuation of what has been a really systemic failure. And it's not just America that's faced this. A lot of Western countries, including my own country, Britain, have struggled deeply with the overall response to COVID-19, whether it's healthcare or government oversight or the vaccine rollout. As you point out, the vaccine rollout in America, after much celebration about the efficacy of the vaccines that have been developed by Pfizer and Moderna and others, they don't seem to be being rolled out very efficiently. There's a lot of reports of vaccines being left on the shelf and unused. Plans to get 20 million people vaccinated by the end of the year of 2020. America didn't come close to hitting that target. They're at about 4 or 5 million. And so the timeline, as it has been throughout, keeps getting pushed back. Well, we hope that we might have some normality by spring. Well, that doesn't look likely now, with just a tiny percentage of the American population currently vaccinated. In many ways, people look to 2021 as being better than last year. We sort of wrote off 2020 as a bit of a disaster. I think we now have to acknowledge that this is going to probably take up most of this year, and it's going to be a long, grim haul, and we're going to be counting death numbers and triaging at hospitals for many months to come.
Ashraf, what's your take on the American system, where the 50 states in Washington, D.C. have their own plans, their own schedules for when people can get the vaccine, instead of having a national system for delivering the vaccination?
Well, this is one of the quirks of the American response to the virus. America, as a country that was founded by revolutionaries trying to escape an overarching monarchy with absolute power, authority is devolved down to the states. The states, the individual states, have a lot of autonomy and are very reluctant to give up any of that autonomy. So as a result, especially with the COVID reaction and the absence of an overarching strategy from the White House, and that hasn't really been present, you've had states competing for ventilators last year. You've had different states have formed up as like almost like different pods to work together in the absence of federal direction. You actually had a kind of a nice story here in Washington, D.C., where Washington, D.C. was kind of being shortchanged on the number of vaccines it was receiving. And they were complaining about it, saying that the first shipment won't even cover 1/10 of first responders. And so the neighboring states of Maryland and Virginia each donated 8,000 doses to Washington, D.C. And so states can make of that what they want. In some cases, there's going to be competition and lack of coordination. And in some cases, you'll actually see states acting like little family units. So it all comes down to human nature in the absence of proper guidance from the top.
Despite all these challenges, Happy New Year to you, to our listeners. That's all the time we have. Our thanks, of course, to our panelists, Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the British newspaper, The Sunday Times, and Ashraf Khalil, Washington, D.C. Metro reporter for the Associated Press. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Dan Ravitch.